One issue that keeps coming up in this podcast is how to talk about art made by people who have done horrible things. I have repeatedly talked about how I haven't covered anything made by Woody Allen or Roman Polanski because I'm not sure if I'm emotionally prepared or even qualified to delve into that kind of territory. This is probably the main reason why I haven't covered the X-Men movies yet. As I discussed on the Pride of the X-Men episode, the Children of the Atom, sworn to protect a world that fears and hates them, is one of my primary nerd passions, as evidenced for how I recorded, edited, and uploaded a podcast about Pride of the X-Men that's more than twice as long as the episode itself. I love me my X-Men, and I have tons to say about the film series that Fox produced for about 20 years. Of course, this brings me to Bryan Singer. He directed four of the movies and has a producing credit on most of the other films and TV shows. He's also alleged to have used his power and influence to sexually assault a number of children. The possibility that Singer used the power and money accrued from supervising a multimedia franchise whose stated thematic agenda rails against the oppression of the marginalized makes me feel acutely ill. I don't like that I spent money that may have protected a sexual predator, and I still struggle to find a way to talk about that. Sarah Green, in an episode of PBS's The Art Assignment, has discussed this in a way that I found helpful. Her proposal for dialogues about problematic artists is to discuss their failings openly and to maybe ask how it contributed to the environment around them. Green emphasizes that enjoying a work of art by a dicey individual does not necessarily make us a bad person, but she does claim that we have a responsibility to not downplay or sweep an element under the rug just because the act of thinking about it makes us feel uncomfortable. I'm largely on board with this argument in most situations, although I'm not sure if this opens the floodgates for some of the stuff that's been lurking in my mind for episode possibilities. I don't think that'll ever do Manhattan, for example, since that movie's about Woody Allen dating a teenage girl that he made actual sexual overtures to in real life. I don't think I'd be able to talk about any element of Manhattan other than how it tries to put a positive romantic spin on middle-aged men having sex with teenagers, and how everyone in 1979 seemed to be fine with that, including the actress's parents. So with that out of the way, let's talk about X-Men. My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive.
Woof.
So, hey guys, let's have a fun chat about a superhero movie we all like that has a monster involved in the creative process. Alleged monster. I should probably protect myself from litigation.
Eventually, we're probably going to end up talking about the Avengers movie, and then we'll have to talk about Joss Whedon.
I already did a Joss Whedon episode. It was before some of the other stuff came out. I have commented on it since, but yeah, eventually. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to rank them, but Singer's worse than Whedon.
Yes.
Hey, in order to maybe put some air back into the room, let's jump into the plot recap. All right, the movie begins in 1944 at the Auschwitz concentration camp. See that air coming back into the room? Nazi officer Klaus Schmidt witnesses young prisoner Erich Lenscher bend a metal gate with his mind upon being separated from his mother. Later on in his office, Schmidt orders Erich to move a coin on his desk, and then kills his mother when Erich cannot do so. In grief and anger, Erich's magnetic abilities manifest, killing two guards and destroying the room, much to Schmidt's pleasure. Meanwhile, at a mansion in Westchester County in New York, child telepath Charles Xavier meets young shapeshifter Raven, whose natural form is blue-skinned and scaly. Overjoyed to meet someone who is different like himself, he invites her to live with his family as his foster sister. We then jump to 1962, and Erich is tracking down Schmidt to avenge his mother's death, while Xavier earns his doctorate from the University of Oxford as professor of genetics. In Las Vegas, CIA officer Moira McTaggart follows U.S. Army Colonel Hendry into the Hellfire Club, where she sees Schmidt, now named Sebastian Shaw, who is revealed to be an energy-absorbing mutant whose powers have kept him young. Shaw runs the Hellfire Club alongside telepath Emma Frost, cyclone-producing Riptide, and teleporter Azazel. After being threatened by Shaw and teleported to the joint war room, Hendry advocates deploying nuclear missiles in Turkey. Shaw later kills Hendry when he is no longer useful to him. Moira, seeking Xavier's advice on mutation, takes him and Raven to the CIA, where they convince Director McCone that mutants exist and that Shaw is a threat. Another CIA officer sponsors the mutants and invites them to the secret Division X facility that he runs. Moira and Xavier find Shaw as Erich is attacking him and rescue Erich from drowning. Shaw escapes, but Xavier brings Eric to Division X, where they meet young scientist Hank McCoy, a mutant with prehensile feet, who believes that Raven's DNA may provide a cure for his appearance. Xavier uses McCoy's mutant-locating device, Cerebro, to seek other mutants to oppose the Hellfire Club. Xavier and Eric then find and recruit stripper Angel Salvador, cabbie Armando Munoz, army prisoner Alex Summers, and runaway Sean Cassidy. They all adopt code names, with Raven dubbing herself Mystique, Armando calling himself Darwin, Alex taking on the name of Havoc, and Cassidy going along with Banshee, despite being a cis dude. When Frost meets with a Soviet general in the USSR and uses her telepathic powers to manipulate him, Xavier and Eric capture her. Xavier mind probes Frost and discovers that Shaw intends to start World War III under the assumption that nuclear war will trigger mutant ascendancy. While that's going on, Azazel, Riptide, and Shaw attack Division X, killing everyone but the mutants, whom Shaw invites to join him. Salvador accepts, while Darwin only feigns acceptance in order to maneuver into a sneak attack. This fails, and Shaw uses his powers to kill Darwin. In Moscow, Shaw compels the general to have the Soviet Union install missiles in Cuba, which is all but guaranteed to set off an international incident with the United States. Wearing a helmet that blocks telepathy, Shaw follows the Soviet fleet in a submarine to ensure that the missiles break an American blockade. McCoy, who has synthesized a cure based on Mystique's DNA, uses it on himself, but it backfires, giving him blue fur and leonine aspects. At the sight of him, Havoc gives McCoy the nickname Beast. And with McCoy piloting, the mutants and Moira take a jet to the blockade line, where Xavier uses his telepathy to influence a Soviet sailor to destroy the ship carrying the missiles, and Eric uses his magnetic power to lift Shaw's submarine from the water and deposit it on land. During the ensuing battle, Eric seizes Shaw's helmet, allowing Xavier to free Shaw with his mind powers. Eric tells Shaw that he shares Shaw's exclusivist view of mutants, but, to avenge his mother, kills him over Xavier's objections by forcing the Nazi coin from his childhood through Shaw's brain. Fearing the mutants, both fleets fire missiles at them, which Eric turns back in mid-flight. Moira tries to stop Eric by shooting him, but he deflects the bullets, one of which hits Xavier in the spine. Eric rushes to help Xavier and, distracted, allows the missiles to fall harmlessly into the ocean. Parting with Xavier over their differing views on the relationship between mutants and humans, Eric leaves with Salvador, Azazel, Riptide, and Mystique. Later, a wheelchair-bound Xavier and his mutants are at the mansion, where he intends to open a school. Moira promises Xavier never to reveal his location, and they kiss, but Xavier uses this as an opportunity to mind wipe Moira, which is evidenced at her CIA debriefing later on. The final scene is Eric, along with Mystique and the other Hellfire Club members, breaking Frost out of prison. The final shot finds Eric dubbing himself Magneto. All right, any immediate hot takes on the film that we, you know, saw for the first time like 10 years ago?
It's gay, so that's good.
Yeah, no objections to that part of it.
Yeah, I didn't really discuss the homoerotic tension between Magneto and Xavier, but it's a long-standing fan theory. There's a prominent meme going around the at least the nerd groups, where it's just a picture of Magneto and Professor X and be like, the situation where you break up and you make it everybody else's problem, too.
Yeah.
I remember once upon a time, like, when you posed the idea that they were exes, like, people in our acquaintance groups or people that we met at like Nerda events would push back on it, but not anymore. It's much more widely accepted these days.
Well, and McAvoy and Fassbender even said that they played it that way on purpose.
They're on the same page there.
Yep.
I mean, it is the most sensible read on this character.
All right, for the development, the concept of a film focusing on a team of young rookie X-Men was first proposed by producer Lauren Shuler Donner during production of 2003's X2, X-Men United. Fox liked the idea and commissioned a screenplay from X3 writer Zach Penn, but it didn't work out, fortunately. Meanwhile, Fox began pre-production on a series of X-Men spin-off films starring individual mutants and solo adventures. Sheldon Turner was hired to write a prequel film centering on a young Magneto. Turner's screenplay, which he described as The Pianist Meets X-Men, featured a young Magneto being liberated from Auschwitz by an allied troop with Professor X serving. Magneto and Professor X would be close friends at first, but their bond would be broken by ideological differences arising from Magneto's obsession with hunting down Nazi war criminals in South America and exacting vigilante revenge.
I want to see this movie.
Ian McKellen signed on to perform in the framing device for the main story, but production stalled out during the 2007 to 2008 Writers Guild strike.
Ooh.
That Writers Guild strike killed a lot of things.
Including a 120-minute that's just a teenage Magneto fucking up Nazis.
Why? Why?
I want this movie.
That writer's strike took a lot of things from me, Ryan. Took a lot of shows from me that I really enjoyed.
Producer Simon Kinberg began reading Jeff Parker and Roger Cruz's comic series, X-Men First Class, which presented light, punchy, and accessible stories about the first team of X-Men sent during the early years of the franchise's existence. Kinberg liked the title and concept, but he felt that the tone, which he compared to John Hughes movies like The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, wouldn't work in an X-Men movie, which I think is ridiculous. I would love an X-Men movie that's done in John Hughes style.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Why wouldn't you do that?
You know, maybe not like all of the John Hughes elements, but yeah, treat the female characters a little better, and there you go.
Right.
Yeah, The Breakfast Club, but with mutants. I'll watch that.
I'm in.
He also wanted to introduce new characters instead of younger versions of Cyclops and Jean Grey. Kinberg also decided that the film would take place in 1962 and work in elements of Turner's Magneto screenplay, which he thought was good and it was worth preserving.
So we got one scene instead of...
Yeah, you got one scene instead of a whole movie. It is a fantastic scene. Josh Schwartz, Bryan Singer, and Jamie Moss all began working on a script at around 2008. Singer denied using Turner's Magneto screenplay directly and claims to have worked in the Cuban Missile Crisis as a narrative backdrop himself. Writer Shuler Donner was the one who suggested that the Hellfire Club should be the movie's main antagonist.
Yeah, so I'm not against that. That's fine.
Singer was asked to direct, but he dropped out to work on Jack the Giant Killer instead. Matthew Vaughn was not a top choice at the time to join the project since he was briefly attached to X3, but quit because he felt that Fox's scheduling expectations were too tight. He was seen as a bit of a diva by producers at the time. Kinberg, however, really liked Vaughn's work on 2010's Kick-Ass and asked Vaughn if he was interested. Vaughn signed on when he learned that X-Men First Class was going to be set in the 1960s. He had a soft spot for the Connery era of Bond movies, based on his later work. That's pretty obvious. And he's also really into Frankenheimer political thrillers like The Manchurian Candidate. So he felt that he can work those passions into an X-Men period film. Vaughn rewrote the screenplay with Jane Goldman, adding characters and dropping subplots. For instance, an earlier draft had Magneto and Xavier coming to blows over a love triangle with Moira McTaggart. Vaughn wanted most of the tension between Xavier and Magneto directly.
That is a solid choice. Hot.
The character of Sunspot was also cut since Vaughn felt that they didn't have enough time or money to do the character proper justice. A direct reference to the civil rights movement was also trimmed due to time constraints. There was also a dream sequence cut out for resembling the recently released Inception too closely.
Inception got, like, really good reviews. It's actually a very fun movie. I enjoy it a lot, so...
I think it's held up just fine.
Yeah.
I use it as internet speak in my everyday life still, which makes me feel a little old, but I'll own it, yeah. Yeah.
I have mixed feelings about their decision to not, like, work a little more with the civil rights movement because it's the X-Men. That would be very appropriate. And, like, the kind of sort of thing that they had going on with Angel and Darwin while they're being tempted by the Hellfire Club. That scene is just, like, reading into it and stuff. It's so vaguely done, the racial element of it, that I think that they could have... It would have been nicer if they'd done it more directly.
See, I thought there were some parts of it that were too on the nose, like when Shaw is giving this speech, me like, you can align with the humans, but they'll make you a slave. Then they cut to Darwin's face.
Yeah, like you said, if they had given it proper attention, that could have been done better, you know?
Have we mentioned yet that it's weird that they selected random ass mutants that nobody actually knew to be in the We're Getting the X-Men Together for the First Time movie?
Ryan did mention that was a stated goal.
Yeah, they wanted new characters, characters who hadn't been in the previous three movies.
Right, so why not Kitty Pryde?
She was in the previous three movies. Elliot Page played him.
That didn't... No, that Yes. Oh, fuck, I forgot about that movie.
Well, you should have. Okay, casting. James McAvoy was Vaughn's top choice for Xavier. Vaughn felt that Xavier is often sanctimonious and boring, so he encouraged McAvoy to be a bit roguish. McAvoy wasn't a comics guy, but he was obsessed with X-Men the Animated Series as a child.
We can relate to that just a smidge.
When he was approached to play Xavier, he immediately shaved his head. But then he was told that Xavier was supposed to have a full head of hair in the movie, so he had to wear hair extensions while they were shooting.
Oh, that is delightful. How do you not just love that? Beautiful.
Vaughn had everyone auditioning for Magneto read directly across from McAvoy because he wanted their association to be, to have the appropriate amount of energy.
You mean tension. He wanted the right amount of sexual tension.
UST. So this whole thing was designed with, like, the many LiveJournal and Tumblr fanfics that it spawned in mind.
It's gay, yes, it's gay.
Have you guys seen the Gordon clip where they're sitting on the couch and they're talking about the fan fiction that's made about them?
I have not.
It is delightful. They go through fan art, and there is a lot of fan art of them, and they critique it, and it's fantastic.
Have you seen N.D. Stevenson's X-Men First Class fan art?
No.
Okay, so it's all done in the She-Ra style, obviously, and it's Professor X and Magneto having moments together, and then Mystique is like, hi guys, I'm still here, and they're like, go away, Raven.
Oh, that sounds adorable.
It was just like a switch flip suddenly, like that was the pairing. It was just everywhere. Mm. Even if you weren't looking for that fandom, it would show up.
Well, and I mean, we were in, like, peak, like, that was, like, the beginning of, like, the golden age of fan fiction for, like, our generation. Like, Tumblr. That just made my, like, 2012 heart sing.
That's your golden age? Oh, I used to, like, crawl through, like, fanfiction.net when we were, like, 13.
Well, me too. I started reading fanfic for The X-Files when I was 11 years old. So, like, around the same time that you, yeah, because that math. Yeah, no, and then, like, it just, like, I don't know. I felt like it just kept getting better.
Probably more fun when we were in college.
I mean, I love being in fandoms, but, like, and suddenly, like, fanfic just became, like, an acceptable thing. We were in college, and I was like, all right, I'm here for it.
Yeah, AO3 is such a better site.
But I don't know. I do have some nostalgia for the old days in high school.
Oh, LiveJournal.
What was that site
we used to read the Obi-Wan fanfiction off of?
Oh, Sith Academy.
Yes, Sith Academy.
Anyway, this has nothing to do with X-Men.
Sorry.
Michael Fassbender was invited to audition for Magneto because Vaughn remembered Fassbender from when he auditioned for Stardust, and he thought that since McAvoy and Fassbender were both in Band of Brothers together, they might have good chemistry. So he sent him a copy of the screenplay. Fassbender had no familiarity with the X-Men, but he felt that Magneto was an interesting role and saw him largely as a Machiavellian wild card.
Yeah, that's an accurate description of how they use the Magneto character over the years.
I mean, I'm gonna, like, this is a bit difficult for me as a concept, but say I was not familiar with X-Men from age 6 on. If someone sent me a screenplay and was like, hey, this character seems cool, and it was Magneto, yeah, that's not a hard pitch. Like, that is a very interesting character in pop culture.
He's got Neato right there in the name.
People like that. It's Neato.
Oh.
Colin Firth was on the shortlist for Sebastian Shaw, but Kevin Bacon won out because they thought that he came across as more menacing. Vaughn Wood.
And he does.
Well, yes. Yes,
and Vaughn would use Firth later on.
Yes, those movies.
Bacon took the role because, while he wasn't a comics kid either, he liked the socio-political subtext of the story.
That's delightful. Way to go, Kevin Bacon.
Rosamund Pike was considered for Moira MacTaggert, but it took a while for them to settle on Rose Byrne. She was cast really late. They were shooting, actually, in fact, when she officially got the role.
So why did they not go for a silly Scottish accent there?
She thought that she was going to do the Scottish accent. James McAvoy, in particular, was very disappointed that she wasn't.
Have you, I mean, you've heard him speak, yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can totally understand.
Amber Heard was considered for Mystique for a bit, but Jennifer Lawrence pursued the role because she wanted to do a lighter project after Winter's Bone.
Fair enough.
Vaughn offered her Mystique because he thought Lawrence could pull off a sense of vulnerability that the Rebecca Romijn iteration of Mystique didn't really have. Lawrence was reluctant since she was a bit intimidated by Rebecca Romijn's performance in the first three X-Men movies.
Understandable.
Lawrence was pitched Mystique as sort of a sweet and naive character that would ultimately become sultry and mean with a more world-weary attitude that she displayed in the Singer films. Lawrence had to go through 8 hours of makeup, resulting in blisters. She had to work out for 2 hours a day in order to, you know, look screen presentable by producer standards.
I remember her. Yeah, this was a period where the tabloids were really on her body. I remember that. She was being fat shamed left, right, and center.
Oh, yeah. That is definitely...
Yeah, J-Law is an astonishingly attractive Hollywood starlet, but she doesn't look like Rebecca Romijn.
No.
Well, and she does have, like, a little more meat on her bones than, like, Amber Heard, but
right.
That's not a bad thing. She's got curves.
Oh, it's not a bad thing. It's just, as Sylvan said, the tabloids were going fucking nuts on her. My legislator.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, the tabloids were going fucking nuts on her. They were body shaming the shit out of poor J-Law. And she's beautiful, and she came out on top of that. I don't think people talk about her badly anymore. I think that's gone out of fashion for the most part.
I did find out that they had actually preserved some of Rebecca Romijn's prosthetics from the first three movies and reused them on J-Law, which I thought was a nice touch.
Yeah, that is nice.
And the cameo was cute.
Yeah.
That was a fun cameo. And also the longest enduring X-Men First Class meme.
That's right.
Morgan Lilly, who played the child Mystique, got a slip-on bodysuit and 90 minutes of makeup instead of 8 hours because she was a child. In case you were wondering if they also tortured that poor little girl. Jason Fleming was cast as Azazel, despite the fact that he was opposed to makeup-heavy roles after appearing in Clash of the Titans.
That poor fucking man.
He changed his mind because he really liked working with Matthew Vaughn and wanted to do something else with him. However, Matthew Vaughn pulled him aside and said, hey, Azazel is not what we would call a fan favorite character in the X-Men community, so you might have to carry some of that.
Oh.
I'm not going to get into the Chuck Austin run on Uncanny X-Men because we're going to have enough digressions, but yeah.
There's going to be enough that you have to cut. Just keep going.
All right, Zoe Kravitz as yes. Angel Salvadori. Zoe Kravitz is a much bigger deal now than she was in 2010.
The child of Lisa Bonet and Lenny Kravitz. But yeah, she had not yet really become Zoe Kravitz as we know her. Because she's a fucking powerhouse on her own now. But, you know, back then she was still, you know, okay.
Yeah, when I saw her in X-Men First Class, I was like, wow, she's really pretty. Who is that? I was like,
why is she playing Angel?
Oh, yeah, her two parents are just genetically perfect. Of course she's pretty.
Right.
The character is. That was an opportunity to cast somebody with, like, a different body type, let's say.
Yeah, Angel comes from the Grant Morrison-Frank Whiteley run in New X-Men, and Angel, as depicted in that, is really chubby and awkward.
I mean, so here's going to be another example of a poor actress who's been fat-shamed a lot, but, you know, they could have given that role to America Ferrera.
Oh, they could have.
I suppose they could have, but yeah, they're not going to.
It would have been nice if they would have cast somebody who wasn't conventionally attractive.
Yeah, Frank Whiteley didn't draw her conventionally attractive, and America Ferrera does have some meat on her bones, but she's very beautiful.
Oh, yeah,
well.
She's gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah, she's movie star pretty. Speaking of movie star pretty, January Jones is Emma Frost. This is not a popular depiction of the character.
Oh, not at all. And it seems like it was a waste. Like, she's been good in other things, and we just don't understand why she dropped the ball on this so hard.
If you watch her in Mad Men, you'd think that she'd be a perfect Emma Frost.
Oh, she's fantastic in Mad Men. And yeah, she has the attitude. It's sort of like poor Robert Pattinson. It's sort of like him or Kristen Stewart. You know, they're terrible performances in Twilight. When you see them in another movie where they're working with a good director who gives them good direction, suddenly they can act and they're fantastic.
Yeah, all
I was thinking about that while we were watching this. The lines that she has and stuff, like, they could have potentially worked. She just would have had to, like, do them differently. But those were the takes they liked.
Have more of an attitude and be more of a go fuck yourself. I don't care. I'm doing whatever I want.
Yeah, Emma Frost is supposed to be, like, campy ice bitch on wheels. She's supposed to be a Disney Renaissance villain.
Not not a Bond villain's side chick who's in, like, fluffy... sort of revealing clothes.
Very specific.
Yeah.
Very specific descriptor, but I get it.
Well, there's that scene where she's wearing the puffy stuff.
When she's in Russia.
Yeah.
Rosamund Pike, Alice Eve, Sarah Harding, and Tanya McManus were all considered. Jones took the role because she thought it would be a change of pace for Mad Men, and then she shrugged when she found out that it was a 1960s period piece.
So she gets typecast, whatever, it happens.
She said that she didn't really exercise any more than usual for the part, despite Emma's ridiculous costume. She figured that since she's naturally petite, the lingerie would just work out.
And it did.
Nobody criticizes her for her looks. Yeah, she looked like Emma Frost.
Yeah.
And I don't think all of her lines were great. She was saddled with the thing about war is that there's an equal chance of both sides winning. It was like, that is not true for the history of most war. And then we have Caleb Landry Jones as Banshee. He auditioned without knowing which X-Man he was up for. He figured his red hair and freckles would prevent him from being a more traditional superhero. He didn't think he was ever going to be Batman. When he did some research on Banshee, he tried to work in revealing glances to Rose Byrne during his scenes where they're interacting. He is acrophobic, so the flying scenes were not super great for him.
Oh, no! Oh, poor Banshee.
Yeah, his Banshee's training montage is just like him trying to use his supersonic powers to fly, and then Magneto just shoving him off the precipice.
So
that was kind of like method acting.
Did they do the thing to him that they did to Alan Rickman where like they didn't warn him?
I don't think they did.
Okay, because poor Alan Rickman. That makes that scene so much. I imagine we'll do Die Hard eventually. Yeah, so they don't give you any warning and just poof. No fucking thanks.
All right, Edie Gathegi is Darwin. He auditioned for Banshee.
That would have been cool.
He thought he was up for it. He didn't know he was going to play Darwin until the day before shooting began.
Did he know who Darwin was?
Do you know who Darwin is?
I remember leaving the theater and being like, Ryan, who's that character? And you being like, I don't know. And then me being like, Ryan, the walking X-Men encyclopedia, didn't know who this character was.
He's a recentish character. He popped up during Ed Brubaker's run. Brubaker retconned that when the original X-Men team were captured by Krakoa and the new X-Men team with like Wolverine and Nightcrawler and Colossus were sent in to rescue him, they were the second wave. He had recruited a first wave who failed miserably, and then he just decided not to tell anybody about them. Yeah, Darwin was on that first team.
Alrighty. So, in the comics as well as the movies, Darwin's never had much.
No, he hasn't. Mm-hmm. Alright, we have Lucas Till as Havoc, and amongst the other things about this X-Men team driving comics nerds up the wall, Havoc joining the team before Cyclops.
Well, the younger brother, like, this makes no sense chronologically.
No, but also, I mean, I guess I don't really remember Havoc on the X-Men show, but the way that they show his power does not appear to be what I have in my memory.
Yeah, Havoc's whole thing is that he can't control it without a full bodysuit. He doesn't get a visor like his bro.
Right, but, like, it usually shoots out of his chest in, like, a straight line or something, right? No, it does the twirl thing.
Yeah, it does concentric circles. Neil Adams came up with that because he wanted to do some kind of visual effect that Jack Kirby probably wouldn't have done.
Ah, okay. All right. So then I guess I can't complain, but yeah.
Till auditioned for both Beast and Havoc, but he demanded Havoc when he found out what the Beast makeup procedure would entail.
Fair enough. I mean, what did he expect with Beast, though?
Maybe he wasn't familiar with the comics.
The character's name is Beast.
All right, speaking of which, Nicholas Holt is Beast.
Okay, I loved his performance, although I remember we talked about this too. Like, so are we supposed to think that this kid is going to grow up into Kelsey Grammer or not?
Listen, Kelsey Grammer as Beast is like one of the best things I've ever seen, so...
Well, Vaughn's whole thing is that this was a soft reset and they weren't going to pay too much attention to the previous X-Men movies.
I mean, that's comics. Retcons, go for it.
Benjamin Walker was initially cast, but he left to perform in Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, so Holt was kind of the last-minute replacement. He was subjected to 4 hours of makeup, and as I intimated earlier, they wanted to make him look a lot more feral than Kelsey Grammer did in X3, Soft Reset.
I mean, I thought that was really good casting. I loved his performance as Beast.
This film was shot on location in Oxford, England, in Russia, in Argentina, Washington, D.C., and the Mojave Desert. Fox's L.A. soundstages were also used, and the Englefield House in Berkshire served as the X-Mansion.
Maybe they could have saved some of their budget from on-location shooting and put that into special effects.
Yeah, because whenever Emma Frost turns into her diamond form, it looks like she's in Virtua Fighter.
Yeah, it's not good.
Also, like, a lot of the dramatic tension from young Magneto freaking out after his mom is shot is absolutely ruined by how bad those floating knives look.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
The movie's climax was shot on Jekyll Island, although the palm trees needed to be painted since it was December and the leaves were wilting. Additional island scenes were filmed on Long Beach sound stages. The filming schedule wound up being even tighter than the proposed X3 schedule that Vaughn dismissed as impractical years ago. This is one of those film shoots where everybody was hooking up with everybody. Everyone in particular seemed to have a crush on Michael Fassbender.
You don't say.
Really?
Although he wound up hooking up with Zoe Kravitz.
Good for him,
right?
Meanwhile, J-Law was hooking up with Nicholas Holt.
I knew about that, actually. I think that was in, like, tabloids or something at the time.
I mean, it comes through.
Yeah, it does.
Vaughn, along with five cinematographers, wanted X-Men First Class to resemble a 1960s spy thriller. He's really into 1960s spy thrillers.
You don't say.
The aspect ratio is anamorphic widescreen. The shots were longer than most 21st century genre films, and old-fashioned filmmaking features such as lens flares and chromatic aberration and edge fringing were deliberately employed. The X-Men uniforms were blue and gold in a reference to the 1960s comics, albeit with a Kennedy-era space race redesign. The yellow bits were made with a rare type of Chinese silk and was quite expensive. Another thing that could have gone into making Emma Frost's diamond form look a little less shitty. The music was done by Henry Jackman, who also scored Kick-Ass. It was composed to specifically emulate John Barry's Bond movie scores, which have a posh sort of pops vibe to them. He composed a Superman-style motif, which Vaughn felt was too triumphant for a team of newbies, so it's only used in the last third of the film, with a stretched halftime variation employed in earlier scenes. Magneto and Shaw's music was meant to be eerily similar, in order to, like, draw parallels between the characters, and it was reused in Kingsman: The Golden Circle. Love Love by Take That was used in the end credits. Vaughn had Gary Barlow watch a rough cut of the film and asked him to compose a song for the credits. Gnarls Barkley's run, A Natural Disaster, was used for the recruitment montage. All right, for the release and the reception, while profitable, the last few X-Men movies got less than glowing reviews, and X-Men First Class was largely well-received by critics by comparison. It was seen as a welcome course correction after the hazardous failures of X3 and X-Men Origins Wolverine.
When it came out, I initially had no interest in seeing it whatsoever and had planned on skipping it. And then I kept hearing from people that, no, wait, it's good. It's an X-Men movie that's good. And didn't it start making money after release because of that reason? Like, all of the X-Men fans had felt so burned by the movies that we all skipped it and then were like, wait, it's not terrible?
I did get a lot of that vibe from the geek community, although I repeatedly come back to saying that comics nerds are not enough to move the needle considerably. They need to appeal to people besides, you know, me. If they make me happy and nobody else, the movie's not going to do well.
I don't love that, but it's true.
X-Men First Class had a budget of $140 million and made $353.6 in returns. That was profitable, but it didn't make nearly as much as X2, X3, or even X-Men Origins Wolverine.
I walked out of X-Men Origins Wolverine.
I haven't seen it.
I was dragged to that unwillingly. I knew it was going to be bad because, remember, it had gotten leaked.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, no. And the person I was seeing at the time was like, well, you know, maybe the special effects made it better. We saw the one without the special effects. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to make it better. And guess what? It fucking didn't. So I walked out and we got into a very large argument and I was called a nerd. But no, it was not a good movie. And no, nope.
X-Men First Class did do better than the first movie, although it did cost more.
Yeah.
That budget was not as...
It did do well enough to have a number of sequels, including X-Men Days of Future Past in 2014, which tried to consign the original trilogy timeline with the reboot timeline. I have mixed feelings about it now, but I really liked it when it first came out, and I think it's mostly better than it is not better.
I remember saying about that movie that I couldn't objectively identify whether or not it was good or bad because it was just like a movie length of fan service.
Oh yeah, it punched my fan button hard, so...
It reminded me of sitting in our bedrooms as children watching you and Sylvan play with the action figures and do the dramatic storylines. And I mean, like, get to see Nightcrawler in a Thriller jacket. Like it.
Oh, that didn't happen in...
That's
X-Men Apocalypse in 2016, Apocalypse. Which is bad.
That one is bad. But...
They had Oscar Isaac as Apocalypse and didn't have him do anything fun.
I know, such a waste for a character. I mean, although Apocalypse is just a giant purple dick, so like...
And then there was Dark Phoenix in 2019, which is,
I never even bothered to watch it.
I didn't even bother to watch it either. It's like, there are two Dark Phoenix movies, and none of them are good. And that's the end of it until, you know, now Disney's going to do something with the characters. But until then, themes... All right, the first thing I have written down is knock before you come in. This is a term that I got from the YouTuber FD Signifier. It came to me when I was thinking of Professor X's position in this film, because Xavier is a compassionate, kind, and resourceful man who wants to help. He's also a ridiculously wealthy man who hasn't suffered a tenth of Magneto's hardships. No matter how much you try to empathize and study an issue related to a marginalized group of people that you are not a part of, there are going to be parts of that experience that you are going to miss. And that's a good thing to listen, to reach out, and to even speak up and participate.
To not say they were just following orders to a Holocaust survivor.
Be really careful what you say, and make sure that you aren't centering yourself in another person's story. And you can see Xavier doing that time and again, particularly in that scene that Sylvan just mentioned, where...
Or any scene with Raven.
Any scene with Raven.
Any scene with Raven.
He's just like, why would you be your authentic blue self, Raven? You're so much prettier when you take your Caucasian form. Those are good men who are only following orders might also be a bit on the nose, but because of Fassbender's delivery, I'm willing to let it go.
Yeah, no, I think they played that part fine. And come on, that part at least was very comic booky dialogue. That scene could have been in the animated series.
Oh, absolutely.
The next thing I wanted to bring up was Mutant and Proud, the limits of the X-Men as a metaphor for bigotry. See, ever since at least the early Claremont era, the X-Men have often served as a catch-all for race, ethnicity, queer issues, religious minorities, so on and so forth. That being said, has its limits that is often brought up, especially in the fan community itself. For instance, being trans in America isn't a superpower, even if reactionaries claim that it gives one special privileges. It's kind of the opposite of a superpower in a lot of contexts. Although some say that it's nice to see a power fantasy where the thing that isolates people from mainstream society is actually a thing that makes them special and heroic. I see a lot of back and forth there, especially when people bring up the edgelord superheroes or fascist comment. And they're breaking up, no, when superheroes were first introduced, they're actually a power fantasy. And now that there are more, like, people of color who are superheroes, they get to live out that situation where the things that make you different from everyone else also makes you exceptional. And that's a good thing. And when people make that argument, I can understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, absolutely.
I liked that bit because, one, I do think Professor X is very sleazy, so that was a good capture of his character. And two, I have partial heterochromia, so I'm a mutant. Yay!
Yeah, I do think that Xavier is presented in the film often as an assimilationist who is pushing respectability politics.
Yep, And I do like that they delve into the whole, like, so as a trans person, this totally, like, resonates with me in the X-Men franchise. I guess the fact that, like, some of the mutations being visible and thus hindering your ability to pass or whatever, it is a really handy metaphor for passing politics. And that's one of those things where I'm a trans person who doesn't care about passing. I'm not trying to look or present myself like a cis man because I'm not a cis man. I will never be a cis man. And I don't even like cis men that much. I'm a trans man.
Oh, I feel but you there.
I will never judge anybody else who is trying to pass because it's a matter of safety. I'm in a very privileged place to not have to care about passing. I'm safely employed. I have a supportive family, whatever. And the mutant metaphor works perfectly for that because characters like Rogue, like Beast, like Mystique in Blue Form have a very different experience from the pretty X-Men. And I do get a lot of enjoyment when the pretty X-Men are really dense.
Yeah, there was a recent X-Men comic where Nightcrawler is leading a support group for mutants who are visibly non-human. And like he's in the group and Beast is in the group and Dupe is in the group and so on and so forth. And I thought it was a very sweet scene, especially since, you know, Nightcrawler is leading the group because he's just a walking cinnamon roll.
I love Nightcrawler so much.
Oh yeah, another thing about the mutant and proud I wanted to bring up is like every now and again, a distant cousin from rural Ohio will be like, hey, everyone's talking about like gay pride and black pride. Why can't I say I'm proud to be white? And obviously that's a question asked in bad faith. But the reason that words like pride are associated with marginalized groups like that is because historically mainstream society taught those marginalized groups that they should be ashamed of those aspects. And it's an act of defiance. Be like, no, being queer isn't something that I'm ashamed of. In fact, I'm proud of it, despite the fact that you're telling me that I shouldn't be. It's a different situation from being white, where nobody who controls the levers of the government has ever tried to make someone feel ashamed of being white, despite what some people would claim otherwise. Yeah, mutants are freaks, but they're freaks in a way that makes them able to save the world, which they do, even if the world doesn't appreciate it. That is an appealing fantasy for people who feel a little different, especially when they're teenagers, which is, you know, everyone feels a little different when they're teenagers. The X-Men play into a fantasy comes across in a lot of idioms. The things that make you feel isolated and persecuted and different and all that, they actually make you better than everyone else, and you're going to use those powers to save them. But they're not going to be grateful, but you're going to be okay with that because you're better than them.
And yes, queer people are better than the straights.
All right, the next thing I wrote down was, is it inappropriate to put the Holocaust in a superhero movie?
I mean, it does drive the plot, but it also is a little uncomfortable. A little. I mean, so it's Jewish people writing this, and that makes it okay for me. And, like, historically, like, it's kind of cool the way, like, American comics, you know, Jewish creators have built, you know, pieces of history and like that. So it doesn't surprise me, but it's still, I'm still, I don't know. Like I said, a little uncomfy, but there's history behind it, which I appreciate.
Back in the day, I remember thinking that it was like an easy out to keep using Nazis as bad guys.
Hmm.
Today, I feel like we need the reminder that they are irredeemably evil and the answer is to always kill them.
You know what? Yes, that is absolutely on point.
Like that text from Superheroes where, you know, it's Cap getting, you know, like unfrozen and he's like, what year is it? There are not, it's not okay to punch Nazis. And Captain America and Iron Man responds and it's like, well, you know, nuance. And he's like,
I was frozen.
No, no, you always, if you see a Nazi, you punch him.
Yeah, there are historical ties between the X-Men and the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were both Jewish, although I believe Lee wasn't practicing. Kirby was devout, and while he was serving in World War II, Kirby did witness certain things. Mm-hmm. It is said that he liberated a camp and that it gave him night terrors for the rest of his life.
Understandably.
I think that played into his work. Mm-hmm. Maybe the X-Men a little bit, but definitely the Fourth World stuff. Chris Claremont is also Jewish, and he's the one who decided to make Magneto a Holocaust survivor, and yeah, he had older relatives who were Holocaust survivors, and that was his way of processing that.
makes sense. So it's good to see the representation.
The question also made me think of the first Wonder Woman movie, which takes place during World War One, and it is a superhero movie that takes place during that horrible tragedy. And it's just like, Wonder Woman happened a couple of years after the last World War One veteran died, so it is officially no longer in living memory. It's like, okay, so now we can throw science fiction superhero stuff at it's distant enough in the rearview mirror that we can just openly do sci-fi stuff with it now.
So this may distress you, but they're doing weird sci-fi stuff with our childhood in YA novels. So I'm currently reading one with one of my students that is set ostensibly in the 90s, but then, you know, surprise twist, it's not. Weird sci-fi shit. It's the future. And so, yeah, no, they're already doing that with our stuff.
Yeah. The last thing I wrote down was Kennedy optimism versus the civil rights movement.
Oh,
that's a loaded item.
Because there is a lot of Kennedy sheen in this interpretation of the 1960s. As I mentioned, Vaughn's main drawing points were 1960s Bond movies and, to a lesser extent, Frankenheimer paranoid political thrillers like The Manchurian Candidate, which were still, like, very heightened in terms of reality and had a slick coolness to them. It's difficult to imagine now, but there was a period in the early 1960s where everyone was convinced that the future was bright and things were only going to get better.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And yeah, it was happening at the same time as the Vietnam quagmire and civil rights demonstrators being attacked with dogs and fire hoses. And that's an interesting dichotomy that this film chooses deliberately not to highlight.
Yeah, I guess.
Which, again, is weird because the X-Men are one massive metaphor for all that.
Maybe they just thought the existence of the X-Men was enough.
And maybe, I mean, they cut so much from the movie.
I guess maybe they were worried about overloading it.
Which, you know,
it already does have a huge fucking cast.
And that does tend to happen in superhero movies where they try to jam in too many, like, metaphors and
allegories. The movie moves pretty fast. You were surprised that it was more than 2 hours long.
I know. It's a quick watch. Like, obviously it's not because it's more than 2 hours, but you feel like it goes by really fast.
That being said, the scene where Magneto kills those Nazis in Argentina, it would be interesting to supplement that with Magneto showing up in Selma, Alabama and just yanking rifles out of the hands of cops in the KKK. I'd have been down with that.
Why didn't we get that movie?
It also, too, would have made it even harder for Charles to frame Magneto as a bad guy. No, you're just as bad as they are.
You're hitting people with fire hoses. They're just following orders. You're just as bad as the Ku Klux. I can't. Suck a dick. No, it's eat a dick, Charles. Eat a dick, Charles. I should call Carlos.
Yeah, I keep meaning to do a Superman movie with Carlos, either the Richard Donner one or like the Fleischer shorts.
I'll text him. I'll let him know. We're all thinking of him.
All right, well, that's it for everything in my notes. Is there anything that anybody here would like to mention about X-Men First Class before we close things out?
Nope.
All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time.